Good morning. Good afternoon. This is Stephen here with a piece of the action. We're going to talk about something different from my usual theme this morning. Instead of peace and war issues, we're going to talk about housing, in particular public housing, Australia being one of the most unaffordable, well, really the most affordable, unaffordable country in the world as far as housing is concerned. It's not as if there's not enough to report on peace and war issues. We've got the crucial summit in North Korea happening, and the imminent fall of the port of Hodeida in Yemen could leave, according to the United Nations, 18 million people starving. There's currently about 10 million starving, so really it's genocide. That's Saudi Arabia and their allies, including the US, and really Australia as well, although they're not directly involved in the operation. But we're turning to a critical issue in Australia, one that's not talked about enough, except in very limited terms. Before that, though, we need to acknowledge that we're on Kaurna land and that Kaurna sovereignty has never been surrendered. A piece of the action respects the Kaurna people and their elders, past and present and future. Aboriginal people are one of the groups that are very much at the pointy end of the housing crisis in Australia. But we've been talking about housing crisis for a long time. What are some statistics? There's a report comes out every year on the most unaffordable cities in the world, and the January version, January 2018, said that Hong Kong and Sydney are the world's most unaffordable cities. Those people who live in Sydney probably don't find they're completely surviving. But also they said that every major housing market in Australia is extremely unaffordable. The medium home in Sydney, for example, now costs 13 times the median annual household income. That is, if you take the middle price of all Sydney's houses, it's 13 times the middle annual household income. Median is often a more accurate measure of things than average, because, of course, average includes the top end, which may be multiples, especially in the case of income and money issues. This is the 14th annual Demographia International Housing Affordability Survey. And the study classified markets as extremely unaffordable. Remember, every major housing market in Australia is extremely unaffordable. They classify that when the median home price is more than five times the median household income. And only 10 metro markets with populations over 1 million were found to be affordable. They were all small Rust Belt cities in the United States, including places like Rochester, New York, and Cincinnati, Ohio. However, many West Coast cities in the U.S., like San Francisco, Santa Barbara, and Los Angeles, were named extremely unaffordable. But that's a situation that's been building for many years in Australia. And last Sunday, Anti-Poverty Network, that we've featured on Piece of the Action quite often, had a housing forum, their first ever housing forum. It's not that they didn't realize the issue was there and big for people in low incomes, but it's big issue, complex issue in some ways, although I think it actually comes down to a few things. The biggest single thing missing in Australia is plentiful and affordable public housing, and we used to have a lot more of it, particularly in South Australia. One of the big people who spoke at the forum was Terry Hemmings, who was housing minister under the Dunstan Labor government, the Bannon Labor government. And he pointed to the proud record of the Housing Trust of South Australia for many years, providing plentiful and decent housing at affordable prices, not only to people on the lowest incomes, but to working people in general. The city of Elizabeth was set up to a large degree on public housing. Of course, to service GMH, who eventually sold out and left the people in the lurch, but that's what multinationals do, isn't it? It wasn't only the housing trust, the role of the housing trust that did that. They also had other, perhaps more controversial policies from an environmental point of view, such as buying up land on the outskirts of the city of Adelaide, maybe 9-10 years ahead of the market, when it was relatively cheap, and then releasing that onto the market in batches to keep the market for the price of land down. They released to both public housing and private housing. The problem with it is that it helped to exacerbate urban sprawl, which is obviously a real problem, not only environmentally but also economically, because it increases the cost of travel for people and lower-income people in public housing. That's obviously a key issue. But it also provided cheaper housing. Now, the Housing Trust also bought housing in and had for a long time housing in more middle-class areas. And the idea was a social mix. The social mix was both a culturally designed policy to mix up public housing, but also to help subsidize the price of housing for other people, because it wasn't a welfare system then. Anyone could have a public could have a housing trust house, but they paid the same proportion of rent as anyone else. That is, 25% of their income was to be paid on rent. So people on better incomes basically subsidized for the rest, which was seen as appropriate and should be seen as appropriate. Public housing, therefore, if enough quantity and quality, moderates both the property market and the rental market. And they do that by providing competition. The competition is, of course, not the kind that market advocates like, because they say, oh, it's the government. That's not right. The government's got infinitely more money than other people on the market. Well, that's hypocrisy, because no market in Australia operate, or no market in the world operates like the mythical Ayn Rand type perfect market with lots of small players relatively equal in power. Markets are nearly all oligopolies. That is, there might be lots of small players, but they're dominated by big players. They're dominated by a small number of very powerful people, developers, and above all, the banks who lend the mortgages and the investments for building housing. So the idea that the public purse competing with that is unfair, it's just nonsense. But that argument has been used, of course, for 30, 40 years to help make the market very unfair in Australia and around the world. Public housing share of all housing stock in Australia has now fallen below 4%. At peak, it was between 10 and 17% approximately in different states, with South Australia at the high end. Now, we all know that the richest people or the richest institutions in Australia are the transnationals, the multinational companies. But the next layer, people who are actually based in Australia, the largest number of them, property barons, dwarfed the number of rich listers from other industries. 51 of the 200 wealthiest Australians derived their fortune from real estate for a combined wealth of $86.2 billion, reported by the Australian Financial Review, not a left-wing organisation, you must remember. And most of them were not the Westfield, former owned by Lowy, family, commercial property owners. They were apartment owners. Apartment tycoon Harry Triguboff is Australia's property's richest person, with a fortune of around $13 billion, according to the list in the AFR. So what are we dealing with here? Well, we're dealing with a situation which for many decades social democracy ruled in Australia. Now, social democracy wasn't simply a gift to the poor. It was a result of people's struggle and of the ruling groups taking alarm from things like the Great Depression and the unrest came out of that. And then it came out of the economic benefits of war. Because, of course, in some countries, the war was participated in but not didn't visit their countries, like Australia and the United States, to an overwhelming degree. And so post-World War, the demand for products of all kinds, military and non-military, actually were the things that got the Western world out of depression, not the New Deal policies. But nevertheless, there was more money around. There was a growing threat, they thought, from communism, so they social democracy was partly a response to that. And social democracy in Australia helped build public housing up, but a major problem with social democracy is that it doesn't necessarily empower working people and poor people. And what governments can provide, governments can also take away. And so what we got was the fight back, if you like, from the rich. That was the onset of neoliberalism, the decisive change from the 1970s onwards, but particularly from the late 1980s in Australia. But neoliberalism, like all ideologies, isn't simply a set of beliefs or opinions. It represents the agenda of a class, the mega-rich, the 1%. And governments, ALP and coalition, federal and state, have served that class interest to different degrees in different ways. The key level is the federal government, because income tax gives them the decisive funding power. And Commonwealth State Housing Agreements was the main way in which the federal government funded public housing in the states. But between 1990 and 91, under the Hawke-Keating Labor government, and 2000-2001, the Howard Costello coalition government, real capital funding fell by 25% in public housing across Australia. Funds provided by the federal government dropped by 22%, while state and territory governments cut their contributions by 32%. So in other words, they were both infected with neoliberalism, and they got on board with the positions of the federal government, and we got into the blame game. We had these endless meetings between Commonwealth and state governments, and each blamed other for things. At the same time, remember, this competition of public housing helped keep rents down, and as that was withdrawn, the rental market started to really peak. Well, still hasn't peaked, but it started to really rise. During the years of the Hawke and Keating governments, the supply of low-cost private rental housing declined by a significant 18% over the period 1985-1996, at a time when the private rental market grew by 34%. So the market grew by a third, but the supply of low-cost private rental housing fell by nearly 20%. Okay. And that process has continued. State governments, as I said, were infected by the same ideology and responded to the same corporate interests. It's an interesting anecdote my sister tells, that she had an argument with what was then our local MP, Kevin Foley, treasurer, Labour government treasurer, and something of a reputation. And she was saying to them, why you cut public housing funding so much? And he sneered at her, public housing, this is about 2000, 2001, something like that. Public housing, that's so 20th century. So people like him on the dominant right wing of the ALP in more recent decades didn't believe in public housing, thought it was a past thing. So public housing across Australia, including in South Australia, starved of government funds. The officers were forced into a kind of zero-sum game, forced to rely on the proceeds from privatisation of public housing to provide the most basic property maintenance, especially for vulnerable tenants, many of whom were frail, aged or disabled. The lack of maintenance can be life-threatening. So what's happening is that where it actually operated, particularly in South Australia, the non-welfare model was abandoned, and the public housing became confined to people on welfare. And there's a couple of major problems with that. It increased the stigma, which therefore increased the capacity of governments to bear down on public housing and sell it off. But it also decreased the lobby for public housing. Lots of working people were no longer directly involved in public housing. They had to rely on the property market or the rental market. And they lost their direct support, or we lost their direct support for public housing, as a priority anyway. It's interesting that process has happened everywhere in Australia, but it's happened most in South Australia because we had a non-welfare model, or the most advanced non-welfare model. So rising property values and housing costs have placed an intolerable burden on those excluded from public housing. Private rents in all major cities have soared. We all know this. Not only welfare recipients, but also working people on low income, the so-called working poor, now find it impossible to buy a house and increasingly difficult to rent privately, especially in Melbourne or Sydney, the two largest state capitals. And by the way, some people think that the Sydney market has peaked, property and rental markets. But, you know, that's a dubious proposition. They'll always squeeze more out until the bubble bursts. But in the last few months, or perhaps year, Melbourne has forged ahead, and it may be that soon Melbourne may be the most unaffordable city in the world. And we've got a bit of audio from Melbourne's struggles about public housing coming up in a minute. Private investors and landlords, as we know, have cashed in on the property boom by pushing up rents, leaving tens of thousands of families destitute. And, of course, government actions have exacerbated that, not only the cutting down of public housing, but policies like negative gearing and capital gains tax, which we'll talk about a bit later. Public housing has basically been marginalised, or one other term is residualised, put on the edge. That's a common experience around the country. We're supposedly in a situation now where private developers are supposed to provide lower income housing, but the experience of people who've seen it is that it's again residualized, peripheralized. It's not in the right proportion, and it's awkward, small, cramped housing compared to what they build for private, for the unlimited market, so-called. So what we get is cannibalization of public housing. It's eaten up its own capital stock, and it's, of course, in South Australia, to some degree elsewhere, selling off the properties in more middle-class, inner and middle suburbs first. So that around about 2006, around 9% of tenants were either on welfare benefits or experiencing some other form of social deprivation across Australia, including close to that in South Australia. Construction of new public housing dwellings is currently at its lowest rate for 40 years, and as we know, existing public housing stock is severely underfunded. On the other side, investors now account for half of all the money lent for housing. It used to be 16%. This indicates that the private rental market is particularly profitable, and developers and banks make the bulk of those profits. Just a quote from economist Chris Martin: low-income households in private rental are the ones who are suffering most in our present housing system. In generations past, they would have had a better shot of getting into social housing, but in our present system, because the social housing stock is so small and waiting lists are so long and it's such a tightly rationed thing, there are lots of low-income households who are stuck in private rental. And that's where the very worst affordability problems are in our housing system. It's in private rental. As frustrating as it is for would-be owner-occupiers dealing with high and rising house prices and missing out on owner-occupation, it is really the low-income renters who have suffered the most. So they've suffered directly as a result of the failure to invest in social housing and keep it growing in proportion to our population. So let's move to a case study from Melbourne. This is about a recent rally in Melbourne late last month in support of one of the remaining middle suburb housing trust or housing authority estates in Melbourne, in Northcote, which is, of course, one of those many Melbourne suburbs which are being gentrified. So this is and acknowledge the source of this. It's our sister radio station in Melbourne, 3CR, and this is Solidarity Breakfast, the union-driven show, and it's about the public housing rally in support of the Northcote tenants.
Annie here for Solidarity Breakfast. We're going to take you to Walker Street in Northcote first up in this morning, because that's where they met in a rally, a much larger rally than the last one that they had. This is all part of the government's desire to sell off public land and to destroy public housing. Walker Street Estate in Northcote, a beautiful place right beside the river there. High price land, really. We went there and took some account of why some people were there, and then listened to some of the speeches to raise awareness and express concern about the Labor government's misnamed public housing renewal.
I just think that we shouldn't be selling off public housing to private developers, that we should be keeping it in the hands of the government, because once you've sold out off land that becomes so expensive, they'll never be able to buy it again. And the government needs to own the public housing, not sell it to private developers.
What role do you think public housing plays in keeping society stable?
Well, you've got to have a place for everybody to live, and there's people who can't afford. The house prices are so high they can't afford. You know, I've been trying to help a particular person who's homeless, and I'm having a lot of trouble finding anywhere for him to live. And he's sleeping out, and that's very cold in this weather. We just need a lot more public housing, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting because the government often says that, one, this is about public housing renewal, and they also say that they're providing places. Nobody will be without a place. But when you look into it, like you've been doing,
yeah,
it's actually not quite the case, is it?
No, I think that in this public housing, some of them are three-bedroom places, and they've got families, they need three bedrooms, and they're going to be replacing them with one- or two-bedroom apartments, and they'll have to move out, and they've got all their family connections in this area, and, you know, they'd be probably moved out in the outer suburbs.
I live in the local area, and I'm interested in what's going on in this particular site, but I'm also interested in the sell-off of public lands when I don't think the community's getting back good value for what they're doing.
It's an amazingly pretty place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in a wonderful site, and it's got huge potential. You could see why they might want to do something with it, but they should be looking at a much more community-friendly sort of approach than what they're...
I really disapprove of the public sell-off of perfectly good housing that could be renovated and is low and fits into low-lying and fits into the into the environment of the, you know, Victorian houses around here, and it's just disgusting. We've tried to protest, going to inquiries and so forth. No notice has been taken at the inquiries. Very sensible reasons were given by a lot of people. It's as if it's just not a democracy.
Well, I'm here to support the people who are being kicked out of their homes. It's disgraceful, you know, like we're short of public housing now and they're selling it off left, right and centre. Or I don't know where it stops.
G'day, I'm from 3CR. Can you tell me why you're here today?
Certainly. I'm Anne Laver. I'm from the Darabin Ratepayers Association and I'm interested in transparency and governance and rights for our local community.
Now, this is a very big issue, isn't it, this sell-off?
It's a very big issue for the local community and all these people will be displaced and they'll be fragmented and they'll have nowhere to go and no support for them and they probably won't be able to come back to this area because it would be far too expensive for them to be able to get back. And not only that, there's not going to be enough room. There's going to be majority of one-bedroom and two-bedroom apartments which are not big enough for the families.
Now, you're a ratepayer. You don't feel that you've been consulted at all about this?
Not certainly not by the Labor government. The Darabin Council have been very supportive of the community and I think that's really good that they have done that and the Greens Party as well. But I think the Labor government are not listening to what the community wants and it's not just in Darabin, it's all over all the public housing throughout Melbourne and it's a disgrace. And they've got all the money. They've got, you know, a budget surplus of, you know, I don't know, $1 billion or something or other. So why can't they reinvest it into public housing?
Howard, are you happy? This is a bigger than rally than the last time.
I am always happy at rallies. yeah, it's a big one and it's still early days. It's still building up. We're down at the ALP State Conference this morning handing out leaflets to the delegates as they're arriving. So that was good coverage. We've got the issue out to, I don't know how many delegates there are, maybe a few thousand ALP delegates.
Any response from them?
Yeah, they were generally polite. Only a small number were actually hostile. One of the sitting Labor MPs told someone to get a life. But apart from that, no one really stopped to talk because they were on the way in. They were busy, you know, had their minds focused on stuff. But even just getting the information to them is something. We spoke to other activists who also had their own protest there for the environment and getting them involved in the campaign. So what I'm actually giving out now is the network and the other public housing organisations are actually running a campaign at the moment because the planning powers relating to the public housing renewal program is in Parliament at the moment. The Greens are going to put up a motion to stop that, to block it, and we need to get the Liberal Party to support that.
Now, the reason for why they're doing it is that they want to do it without having consultation. Is that right?
Yeah. Effectively, what's happened at the moment is the public housing renewal program's been held up by the local councils. Most of the local councils, which are connected to the affected estates, have actually opposed it because it's, you know, doing away with public housing, because it's an overdevelopment, reducing local amenity, reducing open space. So to get around that, the state government has actually taken away the powers and given them directly to the minister so that he doesn't have to get the approval of local councils to make the planning amendments. But that power of the minister is actually subject to the parliament. The parliament can actually block that in the upper house. In the upper house, the Labor Party doesn't have the numbers. The numbers are with the Greens and the Liberals. And those two parties have already blocked a similar proposal in Ashburton and Preston. To stop the Labor Party. So we're trying to get people to spend 5 minutes. All they've got to do is send one email and make four phone calls to the Liberal Party. And if people want the information for that, it's up on our Facebook page, Public Housing Defence Network Facebook page.
Say that again.
So the Public Housing Defence Network page has the information about how to lobby to stop the Public Housing Renewal Program.
And down at Wilkes Street, Northcote, there were some pretty illuminating speeches and...
You can fudge press releases, you can talk a whole lot of rot about improving things for public tenants, but you can't fudge the maths. And the maths is that the Public Housing Renewal Program will net Victoria an additional 110 social housing / public housing units. That's 110 additional units on what currently is on these estates. And for that... Victoria will lose 9 whole estates and gain around 2,000 new private properties on that public land. So that's 110 new units for loss of all that land and 2,000 more private units. And this the government can't fudge. Next, we have Stephen Jolly. Stephen Jolly is a Yarra City councillor. In his role at the Yarra City, he's done a lot of work on the ground, on the estates, in and around Richmond and Collingwood. He's won a number of really significant campaigns with those residents. He also is, you know, centrally involved in fights against developers running rampant across the city of Yarra. He's running in the upcoming state elections with the Victorian Socialists for the Northern Metropolitan seat of the Upper House. So welcome, Steve Jolly.
Thanks, brothers and sisters. I think here we are a year on from the last rally on this estate. And the reason we're here a year later is that we've done all the right things. We've signed the petitions, we've lobbied the politicians, we've done the surveys, we've made our submissions, we've had our public meetings, and the state government have ignored public housing tenants. And therefore today marks a turning point in the campaign. We've got to move it from a G-rated campaign to an X-rated campaign. We need to put a cog in the spokes of the state government's plans to destroy these 11 estates and hand them over to the greedy developers whose insatiable desire for more profits means they're never satisfied, no matter what they get. We know all the arguments. Witch hunting, poor people, and overwhelmingly people of colour from inner suburbs of Melbourne to outer suburbs of Melbourne, handing over their estates for a song to private developers to put, can you imagine how expensive an apartment will be here on the banks of the creek, overlooking the CBD? And in return, we'll get a sprinkling of social housing units, which are not the same as public housing. They're more expensive. You've got fewer rights. They're often run by organisations that have their own agendas. No disrespect to some of the marvellous people who work in social housing, but it's not as good as public housing. And the open space will be lost. We know all the arguments. We know that when these people come back, if they are allowed to come back, because who can trust really the promises of the government? Do you think they can just walk into the local school? Because as we know, in the inner city, unfortunately, there's a thing called education apartheid. If you're white and you live in Clifton Hill and you're middle class, you can walk into Gold Street Primary School or Spencer Street Primary School, where my kids went to, marvellous schools. But as we know from people like Tigas Desta, a single mum from Ethiopia on the Collingwood estate with four kids who took on two more kids when her sister died of brain cancer, who then tried to get her kids in the Gold Street estate, all of a sudden it was full up. The Gold Street school, all of a sudden it was full up. This is what these people could potentially find when they come back here in the future. And that is why there's so much fear amongst the people. We've also pointed out the disgusting political hypocrisy of the Labor government, by the way, who rely on public housing tenants to hold off the green horde, if I can put it that way, in front of my dear friend Samantha, the leader of the Victorian Greens, because it's public housing tenants, more than anyone in the inner city, who for a century now have stayed loyal to the ALP, loyally voting year in, year out for the Labor Party. That's changing, but that's historically been the case. And look how they're treated now. We know all the arguments. That's why we're here a year later. And what's happened last week with the state budget or a fortnight ago is salt was rubbed in the wounds. A $300 billion budget, where all of a sudden they could find money, almost half a billion for a new prison in Lara, half a billion for the Etihad Stadium, now going to be called the Marvel Stadium, I believe. $3.2 billion. There's not a road in Melbourne that the state government don't think is worth fixing. And also, even a little bit for good things like we've just got a school about to be finished or is finished in Richmond. Jeff Kennett closed 350 schools on the eve of the largest population explosion in this city since the gold rush. What a genius he was. Labor's come in and said, we'll fix that. We won't give you 350 back. We will give you five or six. We want credit for that. But do you think, and that's a good thing, you know, notwithstanding the fact that it's not enough, but do you think they went to Richmond and said, we're going to give you a school, so you've got to pay, you've got to self-fund. You've got to pay a higher tax in Richmond to the state government. Do you think they said that to the people who are going to visit the Marvel Stadium? What they've done is they dipped into their $9 billion surplus, which they've got even after this budget, and they just did what they had to do to try and win this election. And there'll be more largesse handed out to marginal seats over the course of the next few months. But when it comes to public housing tenants on this estate, in Ascot Vale and all the other estates, who are some of the poorest disadvantaged people in this state, there's a different standard. You have to self-fund. If you want a road, they'll build it for you. If you fight hard enough for a school, you'll get it. If you're a big company that wants some deal with the government, they'll give you some tax concessions and even handouts. For public housing tenants, they've said, if you want us to redevelop this estate, you've got to give us all your land. You've got to self-fund. What a disgusting double standard. So it's socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. It's not good enough. It's not just about public housing tenants. If these estates go, it's going to drive up private rental markets. The fewer people in public housing, the more people searching for in the private rental market for accommodation, the rents are going through the roof. This is not just a question of us coming here in solidarity with public housing tenants. That's obviously the number one issue. But it's also, it's going to affect everybody. The less public housing, the more people in the private rental market, higher rents, it affects everyone. And that's why we need a concrete program, not just to defend public housing, but to limit Airbnb, to have inclusionary zoning. So when all these private apartments are being built, which I work on in the construction industry, we have a percentage of low-cost housing mandated by the state government and councils for every large development. We want to have a conversation. We in the Victorian Socialists have raised, let's have a conversation about rent caps, which we have in Seattle, in Berlin, in New York, but not here in Melbourne. We need a discussion about councils and the state government, not cutting public housing, but building public housing. We want 50,000 public housing units built in the next 8 years. That would cost $1.5 billion a year. We think that could be paid for by a tax on developers and private infrastructure, super profits tax. They've made so much from us, it's time they started giving back a bit. A friend of mine, this is going to sound like an oxymoron, but a friend of mine who's a journalist in the Herald Sun said to me, you don't even have to tax them. They've got $9 billion worth of profits. Don't quote me on that, he said, so I won't give you his name. These are the type of program that we have to have on housing, on public housing, and link it to every Victorian. Whether you can't afford to buy a house, whether you're suffering rental stress, whether you're couch surfing, whether you're homeless, or whether you're struggling in public housing. But as I said at the start, and I want to finish on this point, we've tried it the nice way, and they're not listening. So we have to now today pledge, in my opinion, to take the struggle to the next level. Obviously, in November the 24th, obviously, it goes should go without saying, you should vote for organisations and parties that support public housing. There's only two political parties that I can see here today. That's the Greens and the Victorian Socialists. If there's others that support public housing, in action as well as words, well, fair enough, I haven't seen them yet. But we know that this battle for this estate and Ascot Vale and all the other nine estates will be lost and won before November the 24th. We can't wait till November the 24th. And therefore, we are proposing two things. Number one is that we immediately reach out to Victorian Trades Hall Council, but in particular, the building industry group of construction unions to say that until we have a guarantee from the government that bad public housing is replaced by good public housing, and that every resident is promised the right of return, we as construction workers, as unionised construction workers, will not demolish, will not knock down those estates until we have those guarantees. And the second thing is, I think we all here today should pledge that if that fails, or if we don't get that, we have to go back to the tried and trusted methods of 4 years ago, when we stopped the largest road ever being built in this continent, $15 billion on an east-west tunnel, where vast majority of people were going to be dumped into the western suburbs through that tunnel when they weren't actually going there. It was a total white elephant for the benefit of big infrastructure companies. And we stopped that through community picketing, through a massive campaign, of which the steely spine was the community picketing. And therefore, we have to say, as young people, as working people, as the community of Melbourne together, that if you think that you can come in and turf out people of colour and poor people from the inner city, and we're just going to stand by and let you do it, you got rocks in your head. We will pledge to have community pickets here every morning when they turn up with the demolition balls. We will link arms. We will stop construction. We will physically stop any type of destruction of these estates until we get the guarantees that we want. And we will force the government to retreat, like we forced the Liberals to retreat and the Labour to retreat 4 years ago in the East West Tunnel campaign. This is too important to be left just to election time. We've got to fight on the streets now. And if we do that, I think we can turn this campaign around. We can win. And we can come back here in a year, in 2 years, and see this beautiful estate with these beautiful people, people like Will, who live here, living in this type of public housing, but 20 times better. We've got the money. The state government have got the money. Let's put our hands in their pocket. It's our money. Take it back and start investing it in the public housing that we need. Thanks very much.
Up next, we've got Fiona Ross. Fiona is a member of the Public Housing Defence Network. She's also a member of Friends of Public Housing. Fiona's a person who's been campaigning around issues affecting public housing tenants for very many years. She's taken up, in the past, a whole bunch of the smaller attacks that have led up to this attack, which is an unprecedented attack on public housing tenants, initiated by any government of any stripe. The Labor government's attack right here, right now, is the biggest we've ever seen in Victoria. Fiona's been centrally involved in the fight against it, and I'll welcome Fiona to the mic.
Hi, everybody. I'm here with Mark from Ascot Vale Estate. He's my brother. And basically, we need to be very, very clear that the major political parties, they do not believe in public housing anymore. I just spent yesterday speaking with Martin Foley, and basically the time was spent trying to convince us that handing it all over to community housing, also known as social housing, is the way to go. So the agenda is all about privatisation of services, privatisation of houses, of housing, and a whole lot of rubbish about how public tenants are going to be better off. Well, we're not going to be better off. We need to make sure that public housing stays in public hands and is managed by the government. And all of this sort of shifty nonsense that they're up to, where in the end we're going to have no public housing left and we're going to all be scratching our heads and saying, how on earth did this happen? And we'll end up with homeless people, like tent cities everywhere. We have to be very, very clear about the threat to public housing, and we have to fight tooth and nail to stop it. Because as Mark was saying, once we've lost it, we can't get it back. So I'll speak a little bit about the relocation. So every public tenant is being assured that they will come back. But what a lot of people don't know is at the beginning of 2017, we had the head honchos from DHHS visiting all the councils because they want the council support. They want this to go through without a hitch. They know that it's huge. They know that it's potentially very unpopular, and they want to keep it quiet, and they want to transfer it as smoothly as possible. So basically, the head honchos went to councils. They went to key service providers, and they said to them that they're only expecting 20% of the public tenants to return, and that they were not to go to the press with this. They had to sign confidentiality agreements. So we have got sources in councils, sources in councils that have told us that, as well as key service providers. Now, I think it stinks that the inner circle have been told that they're expecting 20% of the tenants to return. At the same time, the tenants are told that each and every one of them will be returning. So one of the crucial things that we're doing at the moment is, you might be aware that over Easter, Labor passed legislation to remove the council planning of all these estates. So what they want to do is they want to be able to just rubber stamp all of this redevelopment without any kickback from the councils. And we need to try to revoke that. So we have Howard Morossi. He's been handing out some leaflets today. So we advise you to get on board. We need to put pressure on every politician in the upper house that they reverse that, so that we get the powers back to the council, and then we start fighting estate after estate with the help of the councils. And we do it because it's the right thing to do. We want everybody to have a roof over their head and stop this bullshit. I can't believe that Australia is calls itself a democracy and they're succeeding state by state in privatising public housing by stealth and by secrecy. So join the campaign and we'll change things. Thank you.
Yes, inspiring, but also challenging. That was the rally at in Northcote in Melbourne, May the 26th, so just a couple of weeks ago. And the interesting thing is the differences and the similarities with the situation in South Australia. South Australia, I think they've done it more on the death of a thousand cuts. They drain the blood out of public housing slowly. But then the property developers, the market isn't quite as inflated here as in other places. As it gets so, perhaps we'll get the largest sell-offs here. But we already have the situation that they're just getting in Victoria where the planning minister has taken the power away for larger developments from the councils. That happened some time ago under John Rowe, the Labor planning minister. And so they smoothed the way for big developers. Of course, my own town, Port Adelaide, there's developers are circling public assets like the waterfront to privatise them effectively and make a lot of money out of it. So you can probably think of a lot of other similarities and a few differences between Victoria and South Australia. Last thing I want to talk about is I mentioned earlier that one of the other things that governments do, apart from selling off public housing, to overheat the housing market and the rental market and benefit developers and investors and the big banks, is the negative gearing and capital gains tax discount policies. And this is a short piece from a podcast by the Australian Institute from their Follow the Money podcasts, talking about explaining negative gearing and capital gains discount and their role.
At the moment, because of the tax incentives that we put in place, and we'll probably talk about them more in a sec, but because of the tax incentives we put in place, investing in property is the best place to invest. You get the best tax refunds, you get the best tax concessions if you invest in residential property. So what do people do? Well, lots of people invest in residential property to the point where if you look at the prices of housing, we have overinvestment in residential property. What's causing the overinvestment in residential property is two things: negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. Everybody talks about negative gearing. It's the poster boy of increasing demand for housing. Because house prices are so high, people are making losses when they invest in residential property. Negative gearing simply means that the government picks up some of that loss at tax time, so you get a bigger refund. You're able to write those losses off. But the other big one that people don't talk about as much, and I would argue is actually even more important than negative gearing, is the capital gains tax discount. Now, the capital gains tax discount simply means that you can earn money from wages, from rent, from interest in bank accounts, and you pay a certain amount of tax on that. If you earn money from when you make a capital gain, that is, you sell something for more than you bought it for, you actually pay half as much tax on that than on any other form of income. Half as much tax on a capital gain. Why? I have no idea. What is so special about people who earn money from a capital gain? From an economist's point of view, the income earned from a capital gain is probably the least productive way. If you go out there and work, you produce something, all the other ways of producing income are actually productive. Capital gain is a passive investment, and so therefore it's particularly unproductive. But for some reason, we want to tax this at half the rate. It was brought in by Costello and Howard in 1999, and just after that, we saw a massive increase in investment in residential property. So really, it was the capital gains tax discount that sparked all of this. It was claimed that it would actually pay for itself. Howard and Costello actually claimed that it would pay for itself because it would encourage more investment. Now, that's been thoroughly debunked, obviously, over the last 10 or 15 years. But basically, it was a bit like the corporate tax cut. If you say it's going to help business or it's going to increase investment, then it's going to trickle down and people believe it. But
trickle, damn you!
But really, this is a massive concession for the rich. And let's be clear, 75% of the capital gains tax discount goes to the top 10% of income earners in Australia. There are a few things that are more unequally spread. Even negative gearing is more equally spread than the capital gains tax discount.
So there you go, the big end of town, earning again through the actions of governments. Now, the Labor Party says it's against negative gearing, but it hasn't made it clear what it's going to do about it. And of course, it's kept it going for a long time, so we'll see what they actually say about negative gear. And as the Economist explained, it's capital gains tax that's the bigger the discount. That's the bigger issue when we come to the housing market. So, look, the point of this podcast or this presentation was that the role of public housing in both directly providing shelter to people and in moderating the private rental and property markets can and should be restored. There's no reason why it should be just 20th century, and in fact increased. This would reverse the marginalisation of public housing and its tenants and start to normalise public housing, returning it to its original intent as a mainstream affordable option for Australians, as it should be in a civilised country, not a country of the most unaffordable markets in the world, as we're now becoming, or we now are. Of course, the very end of lack of public housing or affordable private housing is homelessness. We didn't get a chance to talk about that much, but if you in the past were homeless in the United States, one of the things you became was a hobo.